Thank you for the invitation and for the, to speak. This began with an itch at the back of the throat, like we often are seduced by these little flames, these eruptions against the tongue. This, like so many itches, unfortunately, though, is an itch which is difficult to get to, unlike an epidermal itch on your skin. An itch on the tongue is all about access, getting back to it in some sense. In the early 2000s, a letter was written to the editor of The Economist. "Dear sir, I take issue with your characterization of Russia's Muslims as an immigrant population. Unlike the migration of Muslims to Europe following colonialism, Russia's Muslims actually predate Orthodox Christianity." In the pages of this sort of weekly, The Economist, as you know, is a kind of standard bearer of free market capitalism. It's a very steely, rational publication, and very rarely does it show moments of softness and romanticism. And either to atone for this mistake or to atone for its support of the disastrous invasion of Iraq, it started to actually wax lyrical and become quite romantic and began to entertain a what-if scenario. What if, it asked, following the attacks of 9/11 and this interminable war on terror, what if Russia, with its centuries of experience with Muslims on its territory, had shown a different path to Europe and the United States? And what's of course quite rich and takes quite a lot of chutzpah is, in fact, that The Economist would ask of the Russian leader what it never asked of its own prime minister, of course. Like an old tyrant, the Economist was a kind of a publication that seemed to have sort of suffered a little stroke at that time. Now, the story of Russian Orientalism is a complicated one. Was Russia a colonial empire or not? The answer, of course, is it was and it wasn't. If we focus on Russia's internal colonization, Russia was actually, there's actually a lot to be said for the fact that the literate masses, and the literate elite of Russia and its relationship to the masses was akin to colonization of Asia, Africa, and America by Europe itself. And this is something which is developed by Alexander Etkin in his study, Internal Colonization. But as we'll discuss tonight, Russia's story of colonialism is very much an and answer. It's not a or question. Most of us are familiar with Edward Said and his seminal study, Orientalism, that Berndt referred to. Said's Orientalism, in fact, when it was published, delivered a kind of very forceful counterpunch to what had been, for a couple centuries, a narrative of exploitation and, if not sort of lopsided history, of Europe's relationship to the East, and in particular the Muslim world.
The idea behind my book on Orientalism is to seek out the origins and the coherence of descriptions of the Orient that began to appear in Europe in the end of the 18th, early 19th century, that were different from the descriptions of the Orient that had appeared before. Orientalism is really about the manufacture of the other, and that other is really of great convenience to oneself. And it can only be done it is mainly done for purposes of domination. And that knowledge and domination in the imperial context almost always go together.
So I'd like to just focus on two things. This idea that knowledge and domination almost always go together in the imperial context. And the second, that the construction of the other is of great convenience to oneself. Of course, the question begs to be asked, what happens when the knowledge of the other is not of great convenience to oneself? What happens when it's actually of disconvenience, or that it actually ruptures one's own questions of, or one's own understanding of subjectivity, national identity, and others? In 1804, Alexander I issued a decree to found three universities in Russia's provinces. Previously, universities had only been in St. Petersburg and Moscow. And to give you a sense of perspective, this is a landmass that can fit Europe, the United States, and several Central American countries. So when this issue was decreed, it was for Kharkiv in eastern Ukraine, Vilnius in Lithuania and Kazan. Now, Kazan was a natural option because it was really on the frontier, if you will, of Russia's own Orient. And it's what's euphemistically referred to as Russia's own Orient. The idea that Russia would study an area that was contiguous with it, that was its neighboring provinces, countries, is of great importance, and it was not a natural, or it was not a self-evident decision. Also, Kazan, as Alexander Herzen said, was a kind of, he called it the main caravanserai of taking European ideas to Asia and Asian ideas to Europe. After some baby steps, by the 1820s, 1830s, Kazan boasted the first Department of Mongolian Studies in the world, the first comprehensive Turkic languages studies, as well as probably one of the most important collection of Oriental manuscripts at the time. Now, during most of its existence, Kievan Rus, or medieval Russia, the threat came from the steppe. Now, what exactly is a steppe? It's an interesting question that we'll discuss a bit later as well. The steppe is, by definition, a kind of eco-formation of grasslands and shrublands. But you could say that the steppe is a kind of middle finger to the binaries of East and West, of Asia and Europe, or even of sort of desert and forest. The steppe could be considered a kind of a transitional topography, one that is an indulgent desert as much as it is a stunted forest. And the West and Russia seem to agree on very little, in particular when it comes to Russia's own history. But one thing they do seem to agree on is the legacy of the Tatar-Mongol horde, or yoke. It seems that only business management experts find something positive in the legacy of the Tatar yoke. But actually, to this day, everything from sort of chiseled cheekbones to dysfunctional toilets, the Sochi Olympics, to despotism is laid at the yurt of the Mongol and Tatar horde. But in fact, Kievan Rus' relationship with the Turkic tribes living on its borders until the 11th and 12th centuries, or even 13th century, was actually much more nuanced than we'd like to believe, or that we're led to believe. The periods of harmony actually outweighed the periods of or years of conflict. And in fact, in the 10th century, they came together and forged an alliance to fight Byzantium. By the 11th century, most Russian princes had Turkic blood running through their veins, because as most people know, the best way to a Khan's heart is via his daughter. So there were these marriages of convenience in some sorts. But the most important, and also there was a very important commercial network that the Mongol horde, or the Tatarska Iga, in fact, had provided for a previously isolated medieval Russia, in the sense that the commercial network of trading was expanded. But the biggest beneficiary of this invasion was, ironically, the Orthodox Church. Because today, the Orthodox Church is, of course, a great source of the increasing nationalism and xenophobia and a kind of revisionist approach to this other, which is very much part of Russia's own history. Because of the steppe tradition of religious tolerance, the Orthodox Church was actually free to administer to the faithful. It was exempt of taxes on one condition. It had to pray for the health of the Khan. So this creates a kind of very interesting situation. In one breath, it had to pray for the health of the Khan, and under the same breath would curse that very Khan and that very sort of horde that was its considered its overlords. This push and pull is what we call the kind of metaphysical splits. Not the splits of the legs, but the splits of the mind. How to bring together two sort of ideas that are considered to be antithetical, mutually exclusive, or incommensurate into one page, one voice, one register. Whether it's these two walls, the former Berlin Wall and the Great Wall of China, or the two geopolitical narratives that accompany these walls, let's say that of communism of the 20th century and political Islam of the 21st century. Now, a whole army of Russian internet trolls and patriots would be loath to admit it, but Russia's eagle actually swings both ways. Unlike the monogamous German or Polish eagle, the two-headed Russian eagle actually extends its purview to both registers of life. That is, it was a kind of inheritance of the Byzantine heraldry, It extends its purview to both issues of the state and sort of secular, but also issues of God and the sacred. And in fact, this prefiguring of extending sort of both this convergence, in fact, was prefigured by many Russian Orientalists by a full half, if not century, before Edward Said. In fact, for example, Vasily Bartold, a Russian Orientalist, he was one of the first people to identify that the distinction between East and West really crystallized during the Enlightenment. And it's during the Enlightenment that we started to see this kind of very strange combination of linking into one narrative Roman perceptions of superiority over barbarians on one side and Christian prejudices against Islam on the other. The great 19th century debate in Russia was really between Zapadniks and Slavophiles. Zapadniks believed that Russia should look towards Europe and follow the path of Europe in its development. The Slavophiles believed that Russia should look to its Persian, Turkic, or Finno-Ugric roots in some sense. And the opening shot of this debate was delivered by a gentleman named Pyotr Chadayev, who both camps claimed as one of their own. So he was really sort of straddling this fence himself in some sense. He published a tract called Philosophical Letters, in which he argued that because Russia had not contributed to world progress at all, it should start from scratch. And he actually argued that there was no past, present, and future in Russia, that there was just one time, and that was a reason why it was kept behind. Now, you can imagine this didn't go down very well with the authorities. The publisher was immediately sent to exile, and Chadayev was declared clinically insane and kept under house arrest. And this is quite telling and symbolic because it was the first instance where Russia used psychiatry to silence its critics. And it's, again, almost kind of coherent because it was doing so in an issue very much to do with psychiatry, that is, its own identity of a as a country. From house arrest, Chadayev sort of, in today's parlance, you would call Chadayev a tiger mom. Are you familiar with what a tiger mom is? Tiger mom in the sense that he really was a true patriot, and he was really trying to administer sort of tough love to Russia. And to try to atone for what he considered to be his situation or his mistakes, he wrote another letter called Apologies of a Madman. Of course, both of these were written in French, so it speaks volumes to how much Chadayev was either a Zapadnik or a Slavophile. But in this, he argued that actually, that he was actually trying to give sort of constructive criticism to Russia. Oops. Now, this idea of internal colonization is something that Alexander Etkin develops and through the fur trade. He argues that man-made migrations of small, wild, furry animals define the expansion of Russia, and winter roads, trade stations, and militarized storehouses for fur spanned across Eurasia, so that it played a role not dissimilar to the Great Silk Route in other parts of Asia, and that ecologically, colonization meant deforestation. So it was not through the sword, but in some sense, let's say, as we often sort of talk about Islam sort of expanse, but really through the axe that Russia colonized or sort of expanded. Now, Russia has this sort of reverse idea of manifest destiny, in a sense, that if the United States believed in spreading from sea to shining sea all the way to the Pacific, as the anthem states, Russia also pushed first to the Caucasus, then to Central Asia, and eventually to the Pacific Ocean. Alexander Herzen is an interesting figure as well. He's a figure that inspired The Coast of Utopia, Tom Stoppard's play about 19th century sort of Russian intellectual history. Herzen is a contemporary of Marx. He's considered to be the father of Russian socialism, but sort of he suffers from this kind of Magritte-Monet effect. He was force-fed to every Soviet child for three generations. So unfortunately today, people don't read him as much as they used to, but in fact, Herzen is probably the most important memoirist in the past couple hundred centuries. Isaiah Berlin writes extensively about him. And Herzen was very much a Zapadnik until the 1848 revolutions, which failed, of course, in Europe, and he became quickly quite bitter and ended up actually thanking the Mongol horde for saving Russia from the Catholic Church and from saving it from the Enlightenment thinking that he felt was a kind of a type of lazy Philistinism. And he actually blamed this on he blamed this on what he called the Chinese shoes of German make, which Russia has been forced to wear for 150 years, have inflicted painful corns on its feet. But damage was not permanent, because whenever Russia had the opportunity of stretching out its limbs, it would exude a fresh young energy. Now, we'll speak quite a lot about this idea of convergence, not only of time, but of narratives as well. This idea of convergence of East and West, or of self and other. When Russia is so much part of Asia, how does it distinguish between what is sort of self and what is other? But also, by the mid-1400s, only a century after it sort of had shaken off the Tatar yoke, let's say, this idea of fear became fetish. So many noble families started to add Tatar surnames as a kind of fashion to their own. It became quite fashionable to be Tatar or other in some sense. And by the 17th century, over 15% of this nobility claimed Tatar and Mongol lineage. This perhaps explains why until about the 15th, 16th century, in Persia, we used to call Russians Uzbeks from the north. Now, the story of Russia's Christianization or baptism, of course, happens through Vladimir I. Vladimir I baptized Russia famously after considering all three monotheistic religions, Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And according to one of the earliest critics of Eurocentrism in Oriental studies, Bartold, he cited a 12th century Iraqi source. How reliable it is another question, that says that Vladimir regretted his choice of choosing Christianity over Islam. And that it was in fact this kind of isolation of Russia from the Muslim world, let's say like in Southern Europe, like in Andalusia, had benefited, that made Russia sort of even more, made it more necessary to catch up. Now, this idea of convergence also is something which is, you can trace to Russian intellectual history. In Russian sort of literature, but also its sort of philosophy, often you find this idea that rationalism, logic, is the world of the devil. It's the world of man. It's the world of science is this world. But if we want to achieve, if we want to engage with the transcendent or with the other world, we have to resort to irrationalism. And this is something that you find often in many tenets of mystical Islam, for example. This idea that you have to suspend the law of non-contradiction, or this coincidenti oppositorum, as Hamann, the German anti-enlightenment thinker, would have said. You find this also in many sort of Sufi citations. For example, one of the most famous lines of Sufi poetry by Ibn al-Farid says, "In memory of the beloved, we drank wine. We were drunk with it before creation of the vine." So this idea of sort of really combining the uncombinable registers of time as well. Or Abu Bakr, who said that incapacity to perceive is perception itself. So there really was this idea that bewilderment and perplexity were necessary for the highest form of human understanding. Now, Russia's baptism, of course, or medieval Rus, I should say, baptism, Kievan Rus' baptism, occurred in Chersonesus. Now, Chersonesus is in present-day Crimea, and which is, of course, very much in our minds and thoughts, not only recently, but urgently now. Crimea was, you could argue, Russia's first Orient, in the sense that despite having several centuries of experience with, let's say, Asiatic neighbors, it really only started to refer to other peoples as the other, these tropes of what we come to know as European Orientalism, the other being sort of somehow intuitive, the other being not rational, the other being sensuous, the other being lazy, as opposed to ourselves who are somehow rational, pragmatic, analytical. Crimea was annexed following the Russo-Turkish Wars in the 18th century, and Catherine the Great organized a kind of great expedition, including ambassadors from France, England, and Austria, as well as Joseph II, in a kind of show of force. And many of the writers called it a kind of fête continuelle, a kind of a constant party, a kind of Berghain on the Borysthenes, if you will. And this approach to the other was something which, in fact, very much played into Catherine's narrative of Russia as a colonial empire. It was the first time to really extend this this narrative with an actual conquest. Ах мой Мирза, как нужны знания, которые странник почерпает из разных душ и наплеменья. Конечно, должно быть пчелы и брат сок чистый и всего. Мы все пришельцы, ты и я. Вселенная поприще для нас. Отечество не здесь, но там. Прощайте и прибудьте верны. Алле и Белому царю. Никто другой, лишь он един, да будет вашей главой. I just realized, actually, in the English translation, we even lose the idea of Tawhid, of the unicity of God, that is in the original Russian. In the Russian, it says that Allah, be faithful to Allah and the Tsar, because they are one, as opposed to they are, So in court society, a book on gardens, Norbert Elias proposes that gardens are kind of an ideal form of self-representation for absolutist regimes, that they are more accurate sort of approximation of the king's ideals than in his actual control and subjugation of his people. And this is very much true in Crimea, because when Crimea was annexed, Catherine the Great, in fact, saw it as a kind of paradisiac garden. Bakhchisarai, the Tatar capital of Crimea, or Krim, in Persian, which is its etymology, means garden of the palace. Bagh meaning garden, and sarai meaning palace. And immediately Catherine the Great commissioned a botanical study from Hablitz, an ethnic German Russian citizen, to do a botanical study of Crimea. And in this study, Hablitz does something very peculiar. He doesn't go according to genus and species, as Linnaeus, as we've sort of come to understand plant life or animal life. He moves according to a process of a principle of identity, an associative identity. So every plant species he finds, he associates it with another geographical area. So the persimmon is a Persian persimmon, the rowan tree is a French rowan tree. So what he does is he creates a kind of palimpsest of different geographies, but also portrays a kind of transnational aspiration onto the Crimea that very much fulfilled Russia's political ideals. Even the climate of Crimea was in question. Catherine the Great claimed that it was a southern climate. She overemphasized it being subtropical, and others said that it was actually a very northern, susceptible to northern winds from Russia. And according to old Tatar legend, the temperature of Crimea fell by about 10 degrees after its annexation because of the forests that were chopped down or felled during the first years of this annexation. Now, if it was Russia's first Orient, it was also Russia's first Occident, because of this insecurity complex that Russia historically had vis-a-vis Western civilization. You know, the idea that Greek civilization, the so-called bedrock of Western civilization, sort of went from ancient Greece to Rome, Rome to current, it's sort of present to Italy and France, and then spread sort of to England and Germany, is actually something that left Russia out of the story. But because of the presence of a large population of Greeks historically in Crimea, and also the historical importance of Krim in Greek culture, you could find sort of Greek ruins, for example. This was a way for Russia to legitimize its pedigree of being a kind of a Western civilization at the same time. As well, it began to change names. So Krim became Taurus, or Tavrida in Russian. The Dnieper River became Borysthenes, and the Black Sea became Euxine. And this was part of a larger campaign, of course, for Russia to reclaim, or its wistful campaign to reclaim Constantinople as a seat of the Orthodox faith. This attempt to restore Istanbul or Constantinople was really much a part of her Greek project. Now, to be fair, there were some administrative improvements made to the Tatar populations in the sense that, for example, rulings of court rulings were allowed to be done by the local community. and in the local language. And in that sense, Catherine relinquished one of the most sort of powerful agents of any kind of colonial rule, which is the unified language of state. Now, inarodzi is a very complex concept. Inarodzi literally means of different descent, inarod, but also it's like many of the sort of figures and terms we've discussed tonight, it's a term which migrated. Originally, inarodzi was used to provide protection to Russia's non-Russian subjects. So, meaning that access to grazing lands for nomadic peoples or exemption from military service for other peoples. Of course, whenever you use a term to identify an other, it quickly kind of will turn on itself and become a pejorative. And it was only a matter of years that inarodzi became a way of a shorthand for saying the uncivilized, the barbarian in Russian sort of in the Russian context. But the Russian School of Orientology, if this is the kind of the all-star cast of the Russian School of Orientology, they in fact forcefully were very much aware of the political and economic impact of studying the Orient, and they were very much aware of the instrumentalization of their knowledge in the services of power. So in many instances, they tried to actually criticize the state in its attempt to use that knowledge. Just to give you a couple examples, Bartold, we've already mentioned on the top left, he really published the first criticism of Eurocentrism in Oriental studies. He was an Iranologist who claimed that Turkestan's medieval heritage was far more advanced than Russia's was, which today might seem normal to say, but in the mid-19th century Russia, this is quite a claim to make, especially if you're an employee of the state. Oldenburg was a Siberian Jew, an Indologist, who claimed that European imperialism had done more damage than good. Kazim Bek, on the right, was a Persian convert to Presbyterianism of all faiths, and published the first study of Uyghur, and Nicolai Marr, whom you might know for his linguistic theories that were discredited. He was also somebody who was constantly sort of trying to make an effort to excavate the link between European imperialism and philological studies. Now, if you just have a look at these, what's interesting about all these figures is not a single one of them is an ethnic Russian. So the people who are tasked, or the kind of the leading lights of Russian Orientalism themselves, had a very shaky claim on an identity that was Russian or not. And this is something which resonates very much with us, because this idea of accumulation of identities is probably the best way to counter the kind of the identity politics which is often thrust upon us, that instead of being a German Arab or a Pakistani British, it's better to be sort of actually several identities at once, because by adopting those identities forcefully and faithfully, you're constantly asked to kind of resolve the conflicts which arise from those identities, meaning what does it mean to be a Siberian Russian Jew, or what does it mean to be a Georgian Russian at a time when, as we know today, for example, being Georgian and Russian pulls you in two very different directions. Russian Orientalism, though, didn't come about sort of sui generis. It wasn't something that was created from a vacuum. It was a legacy of German Orientalism, and it was really the German Orientalist school which formed the Russian study, Russian Orientalism, in many ways. For example, first of all, German Orientalism also was very sort of circumspect of the instrumentalization of knowledge in the service of power, the German late arrival to colonialism, for example. But also the German Orientalism had a kind of very philological and very theological origin. It was really about biblical studies in the beginning and finding what the original language of the revelations, the Old and New Testament. There's also another kind of German, I think it's quite relevant that we're talking about this today on the Day of Unity, because of course Germans' identity as an Eastern or a Western country is something that we often take for granted. In for example, in the early 20th century, there was a Schule der Weisheit by Hermann Graf Keseling. He was a contemporary of Spengler, and his book, The Travel Diaries of a Philosopher, sold almost as many copies as the Decline of the West. And in this school, you would have kind of a half Buddhist academy, half Platonic school, where you would have people like Hermann Hesse, Hermann Driesch, Hans Driesch, Hermann Hesse, the Nobel Prize winning author Rabindranath Tagore, and Carl Jung all meeting outside of Frankfurt. When the Bolsheviks came to power, of course, they tried to implement a policy called Karenizatse. Karenizatse is in effect a kind of an attempt to allow for sort of self-empowerment amongst Russia's minorities in the belief that the more you allow these minorities, ethnic minorities, to develop a national identity and a national language, the more they'll be attached to kind of Mother Russia in some sense. This Karenizatse also is a reason why Russia's Orientalism is a complex one, because if you think about it, Russia didn't go far away to colonize like the English and the French. It didn't go across great oceans to peoples it didn't know. It went across the border to peoples that had previously conquered itself. Secondly, Bolsheviks, for all their faults, which are many, they had to at least pay lip service to the idea of anti-imperialism. They couldn't be shamelessly imperialist. They had to do it through other means. And third, the Russian Orientalists actually quickly trained local scholars. So by the 1910s, 20s, you already had experts in the field that were from the region. For example, in Abkhazia, Nikolai Mar was a key supporter, sort of mentor to the father of Abkhaz literature, Dermot Gulia, or the first writer of an Abkhaz play, the first Abkhaz dramaturg, Samson Chamba, or Shcherbatskoy, who was a Polish Indologist, was also a kind of a key supporter to people like Gambazhov Tsibikov, who was the first, who created the forerunner of today's Mongolian Academy of Sciences, or Zham Sarano, who documented, was the first sort of the most widespread early photographer of Tibet and published a dictionary of Tibetan to Russian that was then translated into Czech and other languages, Czech, French, and English. Now, it's in the nature of pendula to swing, and Said's pendula has really sort of swung to such an extent that we pity those who suffer its whiplash, and these are people like scholars in Oriental studies today, or thinkers, or people who are linguists who are trying to translate material, sort of primary source material. Now,
the discourse.
If Vintage Books, the publisher of Said's Orientalism in 1978, had coordinated the launch of Orientalism with Khomeini's handlers, they couldn't have done a better job, because this occurred 1 year before the Shah fled Iran and Khomeini returned sort of triumphantly to power.
The discourse is a regulated system of producing knowledge within certain constraints, whereby certain rules have to be observed.
Okay, Libya, exports.
Yes, sir, you American pig.
Nice touch.
To think past it, to go beyond it, not to use it, is virtually impossible, because there's no knowledge that isn't codified in this way about that part of the world.
So it's no exaggeration to say that, in fact, the Iranian Revolution and the publication of Orientalism really delivered a 1-2 punch, and as I mentioned, a very forceful counter-narrative, and opened up several avenues of thought. But unfortunately, often it also closed off many avenues of investigation. For example, the Pahlavi funding of Oriental studies, especially in the Persianate world, virtually dried up overnight. What remained often was spent sort of questioning the institutions behind knowledge, as opposed to producing any kind of, let's say, primary or secondary source knowledge. So what that meant was that it's almost the equivalent of institutional critique becoming the institution itself. Like many liberationist ideologies, something that opened up many new ideas, in the end became a kind of prison unto itself, and it really decimated the field of Oriental studies. In some sense, you could say that Orientalism is akin to anti-Semitism. It has this viscosity, this goo, which is very hard to shake. So, for example, if you're a French translator of Mansur al-Halaj, 4 volumes, you're considered to be an Orientalist today. If you're a Kyrgyz scholar of Sogdian archaeology, you're considered to be a self-colonized Orientalist. If you're a German scholar of Aramaic, you're also an Orientalist. So it becomes the worst kind of identity politics as a shorthand, and does really a disservice to Said himself. I'd like to just end with an example of how the study of the other actually serves as a form of what we call the faculty of substitution. That is, it really allows one to forcefully critique one's own identity and one's own context as much as it is about an other. So this other is really a kind of an agency to a different form, a different type of critique. Ignaz Goldziger could be considered a kind of bête noire of Said about 50 years or avant la lettre. Goldziger was a Hungarian Jew and a specialist of Islamic jurisprudence. He was the first non-Muslim accepted into Al-Azhar University. And when he was accepted into Al-Azhar, to be accepted into Al-Azhar, he had to go through a very rigorous series of exams with the Grand Mufti to see whether he's a worthwhile student. Al-Azhar is kind of, I guess in some sense, Heidelberg and the Vatican together. It is the eminent school of Islam in Cairo. And going through these studies with the Mufti, Muhammad Al-Abbasi, after several days of questioning, there was a kind of smile that crept from one face to the other, because Mahmoud Al-Abbasi actually admitted to Ignaz Goldziger that his father was in fact a Jew. So in essence, you had two Jews sort of debating what it meant to be a Muslim or worthy Muslim to enter Al-Azhar. Thank you.